The Craft of Writing and the Writer's Life, a discussion with two beloved authors. What does it take to write, to really write, to create a novel or short story that is not only engrossing, but also makes the reader think about its meaning and savor its beautiful passages? Today on Maine Calling, we find out from two authors who have accomplished just that. Charles Johnson won the National Book Award for his novel Middle Passage. He has also written six other novels and even more works of nonfiction, philosophy, and children's fiction. His new book is called The Way of the Writer: Reflections on the Art and Craft of Storytelling. Maine author Monica Wood has won her share of awards, too, for her novels and memoir, including Ernie's Ark and When We Were the Kennedys. She is generous with support and writing advice for others, online and in workshops. A masterclass in writing is next on Maine Calling, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Have you ever thought you might have a novel inside of you? Have you ever tried to write one? Or maybe you've just wondered how an author can come up with a sentence or paragraph that is so stunning it stops you in your tracks. We know that our Maine Calling audience loves books, so today is a special treat. We are discussing the craft of writing with two of the best. Joining us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle, Dr. Charles Johnson. He is the author of the National Book Award-winning novel, Middle Passage. His new book is The Way of the Writer: Reflections on the Art and Craft of Storytelling. With me in the studio, Monica Wood. She's the author of When We Were the Kennedys, a memoir from Mexico, Maine, and many novels. Her most recent book is The One in a Million Boy. Her first play, The Papermaker, was performed earlier this year. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about writing or the writer's life? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I'm going to start right out the gate with the big question. Dr. Johnson, why do you write?
Why do I write? There must be 100 different reasons. I suppose I write in order to clarify things for myself, to clarify my feelings, my thoughts. And it's easier for me to do that on paper, where I can return to those thoughts and revise them and, you know, take them from being inchoate to being more refined. I write and I create, I guess, because being an artist is, you know, it's a way of being in the world. You're always taking in information, taking in perceptions, and trying to shape them into something intelligible.
Monica, what about you? Why do you write?
I put little notes to myself all over my studio, and one of them is just a little on a little note card, and it says, "Remember why you do this." And that's what I look at when I'm thinking of deadlines and just the weight of publishing. There's such a chasm between writing and publishing, and I think it serves us well to remember that we do this for exactly the same reasons Charles just said, and also just for the pleasure of being at the desk and working with words. And can I just say one thing? When you asked me to come on here with Charles Johnson, there was something about the way you asked. I thought this was a local writer that I somehow had missed. I didn't know about. I thought, sure, I'll come in and help this guy with his probably his first book, blah, blah, blah. And then they sent me the book, Charles, and I said, what? This Charles Johnson? This is... I felt like it was a bait and switch. Like, I have to be on with this guy with a titanic intellect who's 50,000 times smarter than I am. Here we are. And I'm just totally thrilled to meet you over the phone.
Well, this is an honor. This is an honor for me. And I should tell you that the name Charles Johnson is more common than John Smith for men who are over the age of 40. After the war, World War II, so many parents, you know, gave their kids that name, Charles Johnson. It's very common. The president of the Flat Earth Society is named Charles Johnson. There's
a
TV
not
host
you?
Named. No, that's not me.
Okay. Oh, there's a ball player too, right? A basketball player.
And there's a ball. Yeah. There's a ball player. There's a TV news host. It's a very common name.
Back to writing.
Back to writing.
where do ideas originate? I know, Monica Wood, many of your ideas originate with people you know and the place you grew up. Charles Johnson, many of your characters are historical. How do you choose which one is going to become the protagonist in a novel?
Oh, that's a very, very good question. My last novel, Dreamer, is the central character, the protagonist, is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I guess I put about 7 years into that book, 2 years just studying everything I possibly could about King. You know, all of the biographies of him and studies of the civil rights movement. I went to his birth house. You know, I went to the Lorraine Motel where he was assassinated because I needed to know him. I needed to know him better, I felt, than I did. And also because we've airbrushed Dr. King so much, you know, since his death into a kind of, you know, very pleasant grandfatherly figure. But he was one of the most dangerous men in America in the late 60s and a philosopher. A visionary man, but I felt I did not know him. So when I do a book, I guess, you know, I said it's to clarify things for myself. That's true. But I never come out of a book as clean as I went in. I always try to do a lot of research so that I learn something. And I'm going to be a different person. And I hope the reader will not come out as clean, you know, from one of my books as they went in on the first page.
Monica, you're nodding.
Well, one of the things, one of the many, many things I loved about The Way of the Writer, Charles's new book, is the way you talk about apprentice work. And I find with, as I teach writing sometimes as well, and so do you, and you talk about, you know, how to present this idea to new writers, whether they're young writers or older writers who are just starting out, that, and it's a hard lesson, I think, for people to learn, is that the first things, the first novels you write, the first plays you write, the first poems, the first whatever you're writing, that's not your work. That's what gets you to your work. Mm-hmm. And I find that I hear a lot from young people, I mean really young people, 15, 16 years old sometimes, who ask me, how can I get my novel published? And I always answer the same way. Well, you won't publish this novel. This is your apprentice work. And I try to kindly explain to them that this is how it works. You hone your craft. And I call this the American Idol syndrome, that everyone now wants to be and expects to be an instant star. And with with writing, that cannot happen.
Monica Wood, what was your apprentice novel? What was it about?
My apprentice novel was about a basketball player. I'm a basketball and football fanatic. High school. It was considered, I think my audience, and I have never written for young adults since, but that was my apprentice work, a novel for young adults about a basketball player. It was really terrible.
Charles Johnson, well, do you have anything you would characterize as really terrible?
Well, I'm laughing because, and I was going to say to Monica, don't feel bad because
I wrote
six apprentice novels in 2 years.
I saw that. And the first thing I said, okay, how did he do that in 2 years?
Oh, it was, well, I wrote a lot. I wrote 10 pages a day, 5 days a week. And you know why? It's because I was still an undergraduate going to a college on a quarter system of 10 weeks. And nobody told me that you can't write a novel, you know, in 10 weeks. You know, I'd start a course, you know, I'd write term papers, I'd be done in 10 weeks. So I thought, well, why not, you know? So I did a novel every quarter for 2 years, and I learned a lot. Basically, I taught myself how to write. You know, in the first book, characterization was weak, perhaps. So in the second book, I worked on that. In the second book, description might have been weak, so I worked on that. So by the time I got to the seventh book in that series, I grabbed a good teacher, somebody to look over my shoulder as I was writing Faith in the Good Thing, which was published in 1974. And that teacher was John Gardner, who I think is probably one of the best, if not the best, creative writing teachers in our time.
Mm. Yes, you speak about him a lot and very lovingly in the book. I was really touched by that teacher-mentor relationship, which is something I haven't really had in my writing career, and I was envious of that.
Charles Johnson, you write in your book, The Way of the Writer, about keeping a journal, and you are very, very serious about your journal. Many people start a journal and write in it every once in a while, but that's not how you operate, is it?
No, it's not like a diary, which I kept for a long time when I was a kid. My mom gave me a blank book when I was 12 years old, and she said, well, you might enjoy this, you know, writing down your thoughts and feelings, which I did. I mean, I just fell to the, you know, to these blank pages, feeling seduced by them. But she had a reason. She wanted me to keep a diary so she could read it and find out the things, secrets and feelings I wasn't telling her about. But that evolved when I was in college into a journal, which was a little bit more serious, where I would write down my thoughts and feelings and brief essays to myself and bad poetry, about 80 bad poems when I was an undergraduate. And then around 1972, when I started working with John Gardner, I kept a writer's workbook proper. That is to say, what's in my writer's workbooks are things that are useful to me later when I'm revising a story or a novel. And so they're very important to me. They're a memory aid.
Monica, do you keep a journal?
I have since I was 15 years old. I also have a word book, just a little notebook where I put words in. And one of the things I loved, Charles, is you're describing reading the dictionary.
right.
I have, and I think I'm going to try that, but I don't read the dictionary, but I do read grammar and usage books obsessively. Mm-hmm. I just absolutely love them. And one of the things mm-hmm. he talks about in this book is really the craft of writing. It comes down to the word, sentence, paragraph level. And mm-hmm. I've always thought that any narrative problem can be solved almost at the grammatical level. If you can find the right syntax, the right mm-hmm. tense, the right length, the right sentence, the perfect sentence, then you have solved your narrative problem.
Mm-hmm. See, I think that's right on the money and spot on. You know, I always feel that if you have to talk about what the creative process is all about, it's about two things. One is discovery. You know, everything we do is new, and we discover something new as we do it, which is why we keep coming back, you know, to the word processor. And the other part of the process is problem solving. Mm-hmm. It's solving a problem, and it might be on the level of the sentence that, you know, we're solving that problem, or larger structures. But the more you write, you discover more ways to solve a problem. I used to tell my students, you know, when you critique another student's work, give us at least two, at least one for sure, but at least two, if you can manage it, ways to resolve the problem that mm-hmm. you see in the work of your peer. So, yeah, it's very much about problem solving.
I'm on page 42 of your book, and you write, Sartre once wrote, every sentence is a risk. He might have added, every word is a risk. I've been thinking about that ever since I read that. It makes it a bit intimidating to sit down in front of the word processor.
Oh, I don't think it's intimidating at all.
Every word is diction. It's so important.
Yeah.
You know, but that's why we have erasers, right? We can go over something again and again until we get it right. you know, and as Monica points out, you know, words are our basic tool. They're our basic tool. I think you will enjoy going through a good dictionary. You know, so many writers have done that. In the 19th century, it was just common for scholars, for example, to look at a new edition of a dictionary to see which words had come into use mm-hmm. and which ones had fallen, you know, to the wayside. And I remember when I was young reading that Malcolm X, when he was in prison, would read the dictionary. It's mm-hmm. a famous story about Malcolm X. And John Gardner did that. And so I said to myself at one point when I was in my early 20s, well, what's my excuse? Why don't I do that, right? Sit down and go through a good dictionary. And it took about 5 months, an hour every night, but I discovered that this is a transcript of human experience. You know, you will find a word for every process, for every object, all the things that human beings have experienced. It's there in the dictionary.
I remember having a conversation with my older sister, who was my high school English teacher. And we talk about language and usage all the time. And we went on for about 20 minutes on restrictive and non-restrictive clauses. And one of my other sisters, who's not as inclined that way, looked at us jokingly and she said, this is why nobody likes you.
I think people like both of you.
Yeah.
Monica, I'm looking at you have some tips. I know that you do a lot of writing workshops, and some of the tips on your website, you're talking about doubleness. And the example you give is don't have the sentence, he loved the yeasty smell of baking bread, because that's redundant.
Yes.
Instead, think of the unsettling smell or the clarifying smell or the hometown smell. When you give a writing workshop and you are saying this to your class, are there looks of, oh, no?
They hide it well, but there's probably feelings of, oh, no.
Charles Johnson, when you're working with undergrads who think that they have some fantastic, wonderful story, but they've really just started, what is the biggest sort of the concept that they need to get their head around?
What is the concept they need to get their head around? We both, Monica and I, have taught. I taught for 33 years. As a matter of fact, I just realized it's 40 years ago this fall that I started teaching at the University of Washington, right, when I was 28 years old. So it was a career. It was what I did for half my life. But one of the things I think that impressed me most as a teacher working with young people is that the best teacher of writing is writing. So I would have my students write a lot. They may come into class with one idea, a story that they want to do, and that's fine. But I ask them to do three stories, full-length stories in a 10-week period, and 30 craft exercises from John Gardner's book, The Art of Fiction, and maintain a writer's workbook. So they learned through the process of writing. And, you know, I'm just a facilitator, you know, for that process. They learn best by writing a lot and not getting stuck on one story. You know, it's very important. Towards the end of my teaching career, I kind of substituted some of the Gardner exercises for something I felt they really needed to work on, which is a new plot outline every week for a new story. I wanted them to become raconteurs, storytellers who can, you know, tell you a story at the drop of a hat and not get stuck on one story, you know, for 5 years necessarily.
I love that you're using the word story, because you say in your book here that you think of yourself as a storyteller first and a writer second. What do you mean by that?
I don't call myself a writer. I always wince when somebody calls me a writer. I started writing because there was a novel that wouldn't leave me alone, you know, when I was in my early 20s. And, you know, I dream about it. And so to get rid of it, I had to sit down and write that book in, you know, 10 weeks. And that led to another book and another book. I tell stories. I don't really relate to what people call the writer's life necessarily. That always kind of turned me off. I will say I'm an artist, you know, because certain days I might be working on a drawing, visual art. Other days I might be working on literary art, you know, doing a story. Or another day on martial arts, which I've done since I was 19 years old. So I see myself as a storyteller and don't identify myself as a quote-unquote writer per se.
Monica, do you see yourself that way, as a storyteller first?
It's funny. I think I would – I think writer is the word that I prefer for – I don't know why. I hear what Charles is saying, and I don't know how many people know that he's also a cartoonist. I mean, this guy's done all of it and started really young and really put himself out there. Risked a lot early on, but I like the idea of writer. But I don't think of it as I agree that whole writer's life, the whole ivory tower, garret, attic, you know, quill pen thing leaves me a little cold. But you know, it's something I do almost every day, and it's something that's more and more a part of my identity. But there's just so much more to anyone than what they do, even most of the day. You know, I'm also a friend and a wife and a really great auntie and, you know, a bird watcher, and I sing, and I, you know, there's all these other things that we do. So I think it is important sometimes. We can get a little precious about writing, and it's important to put it in perspective of how you live a whole life, a whole creative, well-lived life.
Believe it or not.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we have to take a break, but this conversation will continue in just a little bit. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Crossroads, providing gender-responsive addiction treatment for women through their Back Cove Women's Residential Program. CrossroadsME.org.
Old traditions get a new sound when Yvonne Linz, Renato Braz, and a Brazilian choir join Teresa Thomason and the Paul Winter Consort in a solstice celebration. I'm John Schaefer. Join me for the Paul Winter Solstice in performance at New York's Cathedral of St. John the Divine from NPR Music.
Join us this evening at 9 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Classical has a new signal. Our growing classical network has added WRMO 93.7 FM to our four over-the-air FM signals, bringing classical music, public radio style, to the great state of Maine. WRMO 93.7 FM serves Blue Hill, Mount Desert Island, the Down East Coast, Ellsworth and Machias, and then some. Listeners along the coast in areas such as Belfast and Camden may also now be able to hear Maine Public Classical. WRMO 93.7 joins our Portland station, 104.1, Bangor, 106.1, Freiburg, 91.5, and Waterville, 99.7. Our goal is to bring Maine Public Classical to more areas of the state, and we're pleased to add WRMO 93.7 to our network and bring you more great classical listening in time for the holidays.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, learning from two best-selling and well-respected authors about the craft of writing. With me in the studio, Monica Wood, the author of When We Were the Kennedys, a memoir from Mexico, Maine, and other books as well. Her most recent novel is The One in a Million Boy. On the line with us, Dr. Charles Johnson. He's the author of the National Book Award-winning novel, Middle Passage, and many, many other books. His new one is The Way of the Writer, Reflections on the Art and Craft of Storytelling. And that's what we're talking about today. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I want to talk a little bit about the schedule and also how you all balance it with your reading. I know from reading your book, Dr. Johnson, that you are a voracious reader. I've actually run into you, Monica, outside on the street when you are literally carrying two tote bags full of books that you're on your way to read, and I'm amazed that you could even lift them. There are so many books. How do you balance reading and reading and reading and also writing and, you know, sleeping and eating meals and exercising and doing all those other things?
Well, I don't know about you, Charles, but I'm a very fast reader. I think if I were a slow reader, it would be a lot harder. But I think of reading as part of my work, an essential part of my work.
Oh, well, if you're going to be a writer, you have to be a reader. And I think we should read broadly, lots of different fields, lots of different subjects, again, because, you know, we're curious about the world. But I have to say, I wish there were more hours in a day for all the reading that I would like to get done. I am so backed up with books. And as, you know, this is probably true of Monica as well. People send me books, you know, because they want a blurb or they want an endorsement. Mm-hmm. So my house groans with books. The first floor, second floor full of books, thousands of books. They're in the closets. You know, we have no bookshelf space.
Yeah.
But when I was an only child. So when I was a kid, it was into books, I think, that I would retreat, you know, and into drawing. They were my friends. I made myself read one book a week my freshman year in high school. And then that became two books. And then sometimes it was three books. So reading is very much a part of the texture of my day.
My mother used to order me outside. Just go out and play. Get out and get some fresh air and put that book down. That's what I would have done. I would have read my entire childhood away if I'd had my druthers. But my mother thought fresh air was good.
It's nice to go out for a walk.
It is once in a while. Get the sun on your face.
Charles Johnson, I understand that we have awakened you from the middle of your night to be on our program. It's morning on the West Coast, and that you usually write late at night. And
Yeah.
And then catch up on your sleep when the rest of us are getting going the next day. So I appreciate you doubly being here. But talk about the idea of a schedule. Would you recommend to someone who is serious about writing or frankly serious about any other creative endeavor to try and keep some kind of schedule so that it's daily?
I know writers who get up early, 4 a.m, right, and put in a couple of hours before they go to their day job. You have to find that block, that block of time. I had students, I remember, who, you know, they've got classes, they've got a job, and then when they get to their writing in the evening, it's like one woman said to me, it's tired writing time, mm-hmm. right? She's tired by the time she gets to the typewriter. So that's why some writers, I think, get up at 4 when they're still fresh. Now, I got into being a vampire, that all-night writing kind of schedule, when my kids were little, my son and daughter. I didn't want to start writing until their needs were taken care of. And, you know, now I got a grandson who's 4 years old. But they'd be in bed by 9 or 10 o'clock, right? And so I could kind of like, you know, start work maybe at 11 and work until 4 a.m, 5 a.m, 6 a.m. And the phone is not ringing. There are no errands I have to run. My family's safe and secure, you know, sleep. I feel like a guardian, so to speak, because I'm the only one up with our 2 dogs, right, puttering around. So those are my preferred hours. But, yeah, I'm on the West Coast, so I'm 3 hours behind you. So I have to get up by early afternoon to answer messages from New York or Boston or wherever, or Maine.
Monica, what about you? Do you have a schedule?
I do, but I keep banker's hours, basically. I would love to write all night, but I did not marry a night owl, so I've had to adjust over the years. But given my proclivities, my natural proclivities, I would write late in the wee hours because it is something so nice. You know the phone's not going to ring. It's quiet. You're the only one up. And there is a comfort in being alone there with your own thoughts. But, you know, everyone has to find their own way. I remember teaching a workshop one time. It went for 12 weeks, I believe, and it was on a Monday night from 7 to 9. And one of the people in the workshop was this young mother with a tiny baby, like months old baby, and her husband would take care of the baby on her writing time, which was 7 to 9, Monday nights. And when the class ended, she never told him that it ended. And what she did instead is she would go out and find a library, and she kept that writing time because she'd gotten used to it and didn't want to give it up. I thought,
no,
yeah.
She was dedicated.
Yeah, it was great.
We have an email from Doug. He asks, he says, you have discussed the difficulties of writing, but have your guests ever found themselves in the zone where the right words come effortlessly, like a gift or like the muse truly exists, where revision is almost entirely unnecessary?
No.
No,
the
really.
The muse mostly just sits around on her backside smoking a cigarette, and every once in a while she'll get up and help you out. That's been my experience of the muse. It's you know, you write, I do anyway, I write when I don't feel like it. You know, you have to, it's a practice, it's a habit, it's something you have to enter into even when you're tired or cranky or the words aren't coming or you feel blocked. You just get your butt in the chair and do it.
Do you agree?
I think I've had the experience that Monica's talking about, but I've also had the experience where a piece or a story just kind of wrote itself. The first 2 chapters of Middle Passage almost wrote themselves. They just came reeling out of me. And I think I know why that was so. It's because I had the story. You know, I had the story. And so all I had to do was trace what was going on from one scene to the next. Now, a more difficult book is the one that I did before that called Oxherding Tale, where I had the idea for what I wanted to do. It's a slave narrative, philosophical slave narrative for late 20th century readers. But I had an idea, and I defined the concrete actions and the characters. I defined those, right? And that was much more difficult than the reverse with Middle Passage, where the characters were already there. And all I had to do was scratch the surface a little bit of slaves and ships and the sea, you know, which is the Buddhist void, to find the ideas there. So I've had the experience from both angles, I think, where the muse, you've got to prod the muse, and then where the muse won't leave you alone.
Do you feel as though you learn something new about yourself when you write?
Yes.
Always.
That's why I write, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm always discovering with greater clarity what I actually feel and what I actually think. I can't know what I feel and think until I see it on the page. And then I'll say, yeah, well, that's kind of right, you know, but let's tweak it here. It is a process of discovery for me.
I think so. And I think it starts early on with journal writing when you're just a kid and you don't really mm-hmm. know what you know. And that feeling of writing it down so you can understand it and articulate it, it becomes a lifelong habit.
Mm-hmm. Charles Johnson, you write in your book, writing well is the same thing as thinking well. How does one think well?
How does one think well? That's a big question. Mm-hmm. How does one think well? I talk about it in the book in a couple of different chapters. Mm-hmm. I think one thinks well when one thinks about something not first thought, but very often 50th thought or 100th thought. You think well when you consider, for example, the impact what you're about to say is going to have on someone, right? You think well when you place what you are about to say within the general context of literary culture. You know, how does this work that I'm doing? What am I bringing to the table, you know, in terms of the history of American literature? I think writing well is thinking well.
You know, this reminds me of something, and I can't remember where it was in the book, and it might have been right around that part you're talking about, but it struck me, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like, be careful if you're writing to hurt someone or to, you know, settle a score, or it's not going to be good writing, for one, and that there's no reason to hurt someone if you don't have to for another. I was very struck by that, and I don't know if it came from a particular experience you had being hurt by someone, or that you somebody else's work, you could see the kind of the animus behind something that you read.
Well, there was an article many years ago published by William Gass, who is a writer philosopher I really admire. But I remember he said in the article, "I need hate to heat my art." Mm. And I thought, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, wow.
You know, there are writers who write because they're angry mm-hmm. and they're angry about something, and that is their motivation, or they want to attack something that they feel is wrong in the world or an injustice. And those intentions, motivations are fine, but I am Buddhist, and so I kind of think about things a little bit differently. I want my work to heal, if possible. I want it to bring joy to a reader. I do not want to avoid in any way those things in the world that need to be addressed, like
exactly.
slavery, mm-hmm. You know, which is all Middle Passages is about in Oxford Tale, my novel before that. Or, you know, in Dreamer, segregation, you know, racial segregation. We have to address these matters. But it's very important how we address these matters. That's what I think maybe you're picking up on mm-hmm. When you look at the book, The Way of the Writer.
Well, and it strikes me, too, that, Monica, your play, Papermaker, mm-hmm. if it was about nothing else, it was about healing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. About?
This, Charles, the Papermaker was based on an earlier book of mine called Ernie's Ark, and it follows the chronology of a bitter, violent labor strike in a small paper mill town in Maine.
Oh.
And the two families are the CEO of the mill and the vice president of the union. And it's about, mm-hmm. And there are no villains in the play. And people who came to see it, you know, whatever side they were on, union or management, mm-hmm. felt that they'd been heard or recognized in the play, which mm-hmm. is what I strive to do, is that there are no villains in any story. There are human beings either behaving well or badly. And sometimes mm-hmm. there are truly evil people. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that you want your reader to understand even the least understandable characters. That's what I hope to do when I...
Well, see, I think that is the best writing advice that you could give to anyone. There are no villains. There are people who are caught in a situation. Right. They might be, you know, on the side of management. They might be on the side of the union. This is, you know, it's very important. If somebody is behaving in an evil fashion, I think it's because of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they're behaving
and
that
fear.
Way. They are not inherently evil, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And also that they can change. There's a possibility of change for those individuals. You know, I believe that ever since I started writing, there are no villains, you know, as such. But there are different levels of understanding that characters have, different levels of moral, spiritual, intellectual development that characters have, just like real people in the world.
Yeah.
We do have to take another break. We'll be back with more of our conversation with Dr. Charles Johnson and Monica Wood. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Rooster Brother, roasting coffee since 1987 in downtown Ellsworth. Learn more at roosterbrother.com. And Casella, committed to boosting recycling rates statewide through its One Bin, Zero Sort program. Casella, giving resources new life.
Intelligence Squared US, where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues. The next topic up for debate: Obama's foreign policy is a failure.
Why did Russia work so hard to undermine the candidacy of Barack Obama's chosen successor? Is it because Obama was failing?
500,000 people dead, 13 million refugees. This is not success.
That's all coming up on Intelligence Squared US.
Join us for Intelligence Squared US coming up in 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio.
What right have you to be dismal? What reason have you to be morose?
The answers to this holiday conundrum can be found in A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. It's back in an imaginative performance by Jonathan Winters.
Bah, humbug!
Reconsider the heart of the Christmas season. I'm Susan Stamberg, joined for a special presentation of A Christmas Carol from NPR.
Join us this Saturday at noon and Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock on Maine Public Radio. Also, Saturday evening at 5 o'clock on Maine Public Classical.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, two authors sharing stories of writing and living a writer's life. On the line with us, Dr. Charles Johnson. He's the author of many novels and works of nonfiction. His newest book is The Way of the Writer, Reflections on the Art and Craft of Storytelling. Monica Wood is in the studio with me. Her most recent novel is The One in a Million Boy. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Monica, even though The One in a Million Boy is really quite new, it's already being translated around the world, isn't it?
We have 18 foreign editions so far, 17 languages for a total of, 30 countries or something. It's kind of crazy.
What is that like? Is that sort of you obviously don't speak 18 languages. How do you have confidence that your novels are being translated as you would like them to be?
Charles, in his book, The Way of the Writer, actually addresses that. And the short answer is you have no control. And some funny things kind of happen. And I have to say, Charles, when you talked about the Italian version of...
Oxford.
Yes. I had to laugh because I don't know what it is about the Italians, but my book, which and the title is The One in a Million Boy, they put this crazy cover on it. It has literally a flying whale flying over the ocean, towing a little toy airplane. I haven't the slightest idea.
And there's no whale in the novel.
No, there's sky. And that's about it. And they call it Little Surprises on the Road to Happiness. And I just looked at it, scratched my head, and thought, well, it's the Italians for you. But I'm trying to learn Italian by reading that book because I know what it already says.
There you go. Charles Johnson, do you have a good translation story to share?
Well, there's a couple, I guess they're war stories in The Way of the Writer. Covers, as Monica is pointing out, that don't match the content of the book, or a word that's not the right word chosen, for a chapter title. You know, there, somebody once said, and I think it's true, that translation is impossible but necessary. As we move from one language to the other, I think we move from one kind of experience to another. So I think it's difficult. So I sympathize with those people who translate our work. And I want to say congratulations to Monica on all of those foreign editions.
Thanks. It's the first time it's happened, and it's really quite amazing. But tell the story, the Italian edition of Ox Herding Tale, about what they put on the cover. It's so funny.
Well, when I was teaching, I would keep a copy of all my books in my office at the University of Washington on one wall of bookshelves in case there was a fire at my home, right? I would at least have one copy of every book, every edition, foreign edition of a book that I'd published. And a student came in one day, sat down for a conference. He looked at these books on the shelves, and he looked at Ox Herding Tale, the Italian edition, and he said, "Why is Langston Hughes on the cover of your book?" And what they had done, there's a famous photograph of Langston Hughes when he's young. They'd done a painting, or they found a painting of it, and put that on the cover of Ox Herding Tale. And it has nothing, I mean, I love Langston Hughes, but he has nothing to do with that particular book.
Oh, my goodness. We're going to go to the calls, and we have Lori calling from Otisfield. Hi, Lori. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. Monica, I was a student of yours back in 1993.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, long time ago.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question for both you and Dr. Johnson. Years ago, I remember a phrase, and I've forgotten who said it, but it states that it's important for a writer to subdue the word for the idea. And I'm wondering what both of you think about that, and whether or not that's something that you put into practice maybe when you're a less experienced writer or more experience or not at all. Thanks. Bye-bye.
I think what you're getting at possibly is sometimes allowing ourselves to be the victim of our own glee with which we work words, and that sometimes a very, flowery or poetic sentence or looping, lovely, syntactically complicated expression of an idea obscures the idea, that it can be kind of avalanched by its own beauty. Mm-hmm. I won't mention the writer, but there's a kind of a writer's writer that every writer adores, and you have to read her. And I simply can't get through more than 20 pages of any of her novels because I find myself just overwhelmed by the beauty of the language, but it's self-consciously so, I feel, and it creates a barrier between me and the story.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting observation. Yeah.
Dr. Johnson, have you heard this, to subdue the word for the idea?
No, I've not heard that phrase before, but I think I understand what Monica is explicating, explaining in terms of that. I love writers who are prose stylists.
Mm-hmm, me too.
I want to see, when I read something, fiction or nonfiction, I want to see a high level of language performance. Mm-hmm. I want the writer to have such a command of the English language that I learn how to use English better, right? But by the same token, I don't want the writing to prevent me from experiencing the story. In other words, there should be a transparency, right? We should pass through the language to the world that the language is bringing forth on the page. It's kind of like I'm wearing, glasses, right? And I'm not thinking about the glasses. I'm thinking about the world that the glasses allow me to see. And if something goes wrong, if there's grease on the glasses or something or a speck, then I become aware of the glasses, right? And I think the language should be like that. We should not be aware of it, in that sense of it's calling attention to itself or obscuring the experience, the aesthetic experience of the fictional world. I agree completely with Monica on that.
We're going to go to Liga calling from Rockland. Hi, Liga. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello. My book group just met yesterday, and our book was The One in a Million Boy.
Oh, thanks.
And I was able to share that my heritage, I was born in Latvia. And my question is how Monica would chose Lithuanian as the language that her character, Ona Vitkus, recaptures through the story.
Oh,
okay. It's so unusual.
Well, this gets back to research, too, which is Charles just mentioned a little while before, and I'll be interested in how you can weigh in on this, Charles. One of the protagonists in the book is a 104-year-old Lithuanian immigrant woman. And I chose her because my childhood landlady was Lithuanian and seemed ancient and was, in fact, all the Lithuanians in town lived to be close to 100. I don't know what it was. It must have been all that cabbage they cooked all day long. But so that's where that came from. And so I grew up listening to some Lithuanian. I've always been interested in it. It's a diabolically difficult language to learn. And believe me, I tried. I have the tapes and everything. But getting back to the research for this woman, because she's so old, she was born in 1900. The book takes place in 2004. I had to go back to all of these different eras. I mean, if she was going to recall something from 1911, and I needed to know what kind of clothes she was wearing or what she might have been eating or whether or not she had, how they washed the clothes. And so there was all this research that I did. And the thing about research is you do so much of it and almost none of it makes it into the book if you're smart. Because you don't, it's again sort of like that language thing, Charles. You don't want to show your readers saying, look at all the research I did. Mm-hmm. You want them just to believe in the world. And I find that over researching for me, whether it's, I had a character who was a flight attendant one time, and I knew how they made the little meals and how they did the, everything. But most of that didn't end up in the book. And I think I did it only to establish my own internal authority to write as this person.
Isn't that hard, mm-hmm. though, after you learn so much not to share all that information in your novel?
Well, I find tossing things very liberating. I always have. So I don't mind getting rid of things.
What about you, Dr. Johnson?
Oh, I feel the same way. We do more research than we're going to be able to use for a particular book. I mean, again, this is part of the reason I say we're transformed by the project, that we're working on. We learn a lot about a particular subject, but we can't deliver all of that, even in a 500-page book necessarily. And also, if it's not advancing the story, mm-hmm. If it's not moving the story forward, helping the characters develop, then it doesn't belong in the book. It's not just to show off how much you've learned. You could write a nonfiction book, and do that. But what has to control everything is the integrity of the story.
We'll move to Bar Harbor and Will. Hi, Will. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say I love both of your work. Thank you for sharing your books with us. My question is about influence in literature, contextual influence from other writers and other books. As you go through the writing process, a good novel needs to be contextual to some extent. All books are about other books, but how do you also keep it independent and make sure that your voice is staying independent from the writers that you might have learned from and been influenced by and just enjoyed over the years? Thanks again for your work, and I'll take my call off the air.
Oh, how sweet.
I do have an answer
Good.
To that, I think, at least in terms of my youth, when I was a young writer, and my students. You read a lot. We have to if we're going to be writers. But the question is, how do we avoid sounding like somebody else and, imitating somebody else? I think the question is developing one's own voice and vision. And you don't really get that often with 20-something, year-old writers. It takes a while to develop your own vision of the world, how things work, and why they work that way. But when you have arrived at that, you find your voice because you're going to express that world in a particular way. So it takes time. So you can read lots of people after a certain point when you've got your own voice, your own vision. And I think they are two sides of the same thing, voice and vision. You can read lots of writers, but you're not going to express the world the way that somebody else does who you may deeply admire.
Monica,
right,
you're nodding.
Because their vision of the world is not the same as yours. And I think, you know, for young people, they don't have their vision of the world yet, not their full vision of the world. And this is why being a writer is such a great vocation, because time is on your side. Age is on your side.
Mm-hmm.
If we had wanted to be, a pairs ice dancing couple, Charles, we'd have been washed up 40 years ago. You hit your peak and then you're done. With writing, you get better and better because you hone your craft over the years. You're reading ever so much more. You are experiencing more of the world. You have more joy and you have more tragedy. You have more everything behind you. And we learn from life. And the longer you are lucky enough to live, the more you have to express.
We are almost out of time, so I'm going to ask you, we love recommendations on Maine Call. I'm going to ask you each to recommend a book for our audience to read. I'm springing this on you, so I know you haven't had time to think about it. But Charles Johnson, if there were one book that you would recommend someone pick up for this long, cold Maine winter, what would you recommend?
I would recommend James McBride's The Good Lord Bird, which received the National Book Award a few years ago in fiction.
All right. And what about you, Monica?
Well, Charles picked fiction, so I'm going to pick a nonfiction. And I think it's going to be The Moth, which is a collection of 55 stories that originally appeared on the Moth Radio Hour. And they've printed them out, and they are it's just the whole spectrum of human experience told by mostly just regular folks.
Well, terrific. We'll put those on our Maine Calling Facebook page. What a treat today, and thank you to both of you for being here on the program. Monica Wood, the author of several novels and a memoir, The Memoir When We Were the Kennedys, a memoir from Mexico, Maine. And her most recent book is The One in a Million Boy. Her first play, The Paper Maker, was performed earlier this year. Dr. Charles Johnson is the author of the National Book Award-winning novel, Middle Passage, several other novels as well, several works of nonfiction, and spent more than three decades as a teacher of writing. We have been discussing his new book, The Way of the Writer, Reflections on the Art and Craft of Storytelling. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of the program at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about end-of-the-year giving and other philanthropic undertakings that crop up this time of year. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.